six, which is going to be a good one. Periodic status review of woodland caribou, western pond turtle, sandhill crane. Briefing, public hearing, and decision. So, Anna, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair Smith, Director Unsworth, members of the Commission. I'm Hannah Anderson, the Listing and Recovery Section Manager in the Diversity Division Wildlife Program. This is maybe my fourth time here. And we're once again here to present our periodic status reviews of three of our endangered species. As you know, our division is going through a process to review all of our state-listed species and come before you with a recommendation on their status. And I'm just going to leave it right there because you've heard it all from me before and turn it immediately over to Gary Wiles, who's here going to talk to you about woodland caribou.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Smith and members of the Commission. I'll be summarizing the status of woodland caribou in Washington here in this presentation. Is that loud enough? Caribou in North America are separated into five distinct subspecies, and the southernmost of these, which is in green, as you can see, is known as woodland caribou. They're distributed across the boreal regions of Canada, and there's a portion of its range that extends southward down into Idaho and Washington. Woodland caribou are divided into eight distinct populations, and one of these, shown here in the oval, is known as the southern mountain caribou population. And it's been subdivided into 17 different herds. And one of these herds, shown here, is known as the South Selkirk herd. And that's the herd that we have in northeastern Washington, specifically in northeastern Ponderay County. It also occurs in northern Idaho and across the border in British Columbia. So that's the herd that we'll be concentrating on in the presentation. Just to touch on biology of southern mountain caribou and the South Selkirk animals, they prefer old-growth conifer forests that occur at mid to high elevations. They undertake seasonal migrations between elevational zones, and these movements are in response to differences in food availability. Group size is about 1 to 25 animals. In the winter, their diet is comprised exclusively of arboreal lichens. And in the other seasons of the year, they eat more green plant matter. Caribou give birth to single calves, and females usually begin breeding at age 2.5. Idaho was the first state to state list the South Selkirk herd as endangered. That occurred in 1977. Washington followed suit in 1982. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the herd as endangered at the federal level in 1984. In Canada, at the federal level, they list the entire southern mountain caribou population as endangered. And then British Columbia at the provincial level also lists the entire southern mountain caribou population. They appear on the provincial red list, which is equivalent to our endangered or threatened status. The South Selkirk herd originally numbered in the hundreds of animals back in the 1800s, but by 1920 or so, numbers had fallen to 100 or fewer animals. And as you can see in the graph here, numbers between 1991 and about 2009 ranged from 50 to as low as 33 caribou. The important thing to note in the graph here is the sudden steep decline that's occurred since 2009. So there were 46 caribou in the herd at that point, and as of last winter, numbers had fallen to just 12 animals in the herd. Herd is also characterized by low calf survival, and over the last decade or so, survival has been below the level required for herd stability. And one other thing to point out here that's important to know is that over the past 5 to 10 years, the herd has spent nearly all of its time in British Columbia. So a few animals do come into Washington and Idaho every year, but those visits are pretty brief. The different groups involved in the herds conservation do an annual winter survey. This is the best time of the year for tracking and then counting the animals. These are done from aircraft. And this is just a nice photograph of a group of 19 caribou taken in 2012. A number of factors have affected the herd over the years. Early on, habitat loss from logging, wildfires, insect outbreaks, and road building was a major concern for the herd. Currently, predation is considered the most immediate threat to the herd's existence. Telemetry studies in the 80s and 90s showed that cougars were the main predator of the herd at that time, but that was before wolves had recolonized the Selkirks. So at present, and if you recall the slide I just showed with the graph, that sudden steep decline that we've experienced, that does coincide with the return of wolves to the Selkirks. And so it's possible now that wolves are an important predator of the herd. Winter snowmobile disturbance is a concern. It has the potential, or I should say, it has the capability of pushing caribou into suboptimal habitat. Highway mortality has also been a concern for the herd over the years. This is exclusively along Highway 3 in British Columbia. That's the road that's just a few miles north of the international border. And it passes up and over Kootenai Pass. And we've lost four caribou to vehicle collisions over the last decade. And then lastly, climate change is projected to bring milder winter conditions to the Selkirks in the future. And this could negatively affect the herd through its ability to forage on arboreal lichens. And also it could indirectly result in higher deer, elk, and moose numbers, which could bring in greater predator numbers as well. There's been a number of recent conservation actions over the last 3 to 4 decades directed at the herd. One of the most important has been habitat protections that have been put in place, and these have been proving to be quite successful, I think. So most of the herd's range is now protected in both the U.S. and in British Columbia. In terms of predator management, I'll just mention that in British Columbia, authorities have undertaken wolf control now the past 2 winters. They've removed 20 wolves from within the herd's home range. And that work is expected, I think, to continue into the future. There's been some very, very initial discussions about maybe expanding that to cougars, but that's still just in the discussion stage, and that would also be in British Columbia if it was done. Snowmobile restrictions have been put in place, and most of the herd's range is protected from snowmobile disturbance during the winter time now. That's in both the U.S. and in Canada. There's been 2 sets of translocations done in the past. One of these was in the 80s, one was in the 90s. Together they brought in about 103 caribou to supplement the herd. But neither was very successful, and so there's no plans to repeat translocations anytime soon. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recently contracted with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho to rewrite the 1994 Federal Recovery Plan for the herd. The Kootenais have convened a work group called the Selkirk Caribou International Technical Work Group, or CITWG, and it's comprised of tribal, federal, state, and provincial biologists. And in addition to writing the new recovery plan, they've also been asked to come up with immediate recovery actions for the herd. And then lastly, there's been some steps to reduce highway mortality, mostly through improved signage along the highway so far. So with all of this in mind, and particularly the herd's small size now and its recent steep decline, we're recommending that the commission retain woodland caribou as a state endangered species in Washington. We received 14 comments during the public review period. 12 of these supported the continued listing or other recovery actions. No one voiced their opposition to that. We had 8 of those people weigh in on predator control and were supportive of it. And I might add that all 8 were specifically calling out wolves as the main culprit here. And then one person also voiced their support for retaining old growth habitat for the herd. So, are there any questions?
Yes.
Kind of discouraging report. The habitat protections, I'd like a little bit more information about that, because you said it's pretty much implemented throughout the range. When you say range, are you talking about herd by herd range? Is there thought given? I mean, it seems like with the whole southern population of woodland caribou, and now considered by Canada, where they mostly reside, endangered, connectivity must be hugely important to retain this. So is that what you're talking about?
So I was talking about the South Selkirk herd specifically.
Oh, I see.
So,
okay.
Yeah. I did not say during the talk that the herd is isolated from other herds in the southern mountain caribou population. And in fact, many of them are isolated from one another. So, and the habitat between the herds has often been logged and developed. So that is a very big concern.
Is it something that's being considered maybe by CyTwig, do you know? Or
CyTwig is mainly interested in just the South Selkirk herd.
I see.
So they're not applying to the broader population.
Is there a concern about founder's effects or inbreeding in the population?
certainly, the small size of the herd is a big concern in terms of chance events affecting it. However, the translocations that I mentioned, some of those animals did interbreed with the Selkirk animals. Yeah. And so there was a study done a while back, and it showed that the herd actually has pretty good genetic diversity right now.
Yeah, good.
So that was the one positive outcome of the translocations.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Keep our fingers crossed.
So we're going to move from caribou to the western pond turtle. And here is Lisa Halleck, our herpetologist, to tell you all about it.
Jump right in. So the western pond turtle is a medium-sized semi-aquatic turtle, and it's one of only 2 turtle species found in Washington. So the other one is the western painted turtle. This is just a picture to show you what they look like from start to finish, and what I'd like you to notice is the really small size of the hatchlings. So this is our most vulnerable stage, and we still have a hard time getting survival of these guys as high as we'd like it. The distribution is on the West Coast from Washington to Baja California. And in Washington, historically, it was in the South Puget Sound and the Columbia River Gorge. Okay. They are declining and of concern throughout their entire range, and they are the rarest in Washington. So we listed them as endangered in 1993 and have worked off of our recover plan since 1999. And currently they are under review by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to determine if they should be listed federally. So I mentioned they're a semi-aquatic species, so they need both suitable upland and aquatic habitat. Both are very important, and they both have to be fairly close to each other because the turtles don't move very far. They use their aquatic habitat for foraging. This is a species that can only eat when it's in water. Mating, thermoregulation, and those are a bunch of turtles right there, and overwintering. I'll mention that they spend a great deal of time basking. It's really important to their health, and they're very shy when they're on those logs. So any kind of predator or intrusion will make them flee from those logs. So all of our recovery sites are protected from human intrusion. The uplands are used for nesting, estivating, dispersal, and overwintering. In terms of survival, so I mentioned the hatchlings, these little guys. In other places in their range, it's estimated that the annual survival is about 10 to 15%. We think it's lower in Washington. We have poor recruitment. Many reasons, but the main one we're concerned about right now is non-native invasive bullfrogs that are large enough to eat these guys. So we head start our turtles in Washington. This is a one-year-old turtle. It's been in head starting for 1 year, but at the time we release it, it's the size of a wild three-year-old turtle. And you can see that greatly increases the survival rate. By the time they're adults, they do very, very well. So the reason we started recovery actions in Washington is because by the 1980s, we could only find two populations. Those were both in the Columbia River Gorge. And a year after they were listed, we could only find 154 turtles. In South Puget Sound, they were extirpated by the 1980s. And the two recovery sites that we have are populated from 12 turtles that were found opportunistically in that area, taken to Woodland Park Zoo, and put into a breeding program. We're doing better today. We now have 6 recovery sites. They're a little hard to see, but in the blue, and a statewide population of 800 to 1,000 turtles. Also, at 2 of those sites, we've been able to get our populations up above 200 turtles, which is one of our goals for downlisting. So in terms of threats and reasons, this is a hard species to recover. One of the big ones is that they're turtles. So everything they do is really slow. They grow slow. They don't become reproductive until they're about at least a decade old. They don't produce many eggs. They don't move very far. And I'll mention, too, that they're at the northern extreme of their range. So in South Puget Sound in particular, we have years where our summers are so cool or wet that the eggs don't hatch out of the nest. And so when we had lots of turtles, and because turtles can live up to 50 years, that probably wasn't a problem. But when you're trying to do recovery, not getting any nests to hatch in a year really slows things down and is problematic. Another problem is the turtles live where all the people live. And so finding suitable sites where we can recover them as well as affording to buy those sites is tricky in the two areas where they occur. Like so many places, we have to deal with invasive plant species like Himalayan blackberry and scotch broom. The turtles need open, sunny areas with grasses for nesting, and our sites quickly get overgrown. So you can't really see it. There's a crew out working, and this is what it looks like after the crew's removed all that vegetation. Mortality, especially of females when they're out nesting, is high in other places. One of our requirements for our recovery sites is that there not be roads where the turtles can be killed. But what we do have is predation. And so you can see the size of this bullfrog. We actually had one that had eaten 2 hatchlings. And there's just so many of them on the shorelines of the ponds that as these small hatchlings come in, they eat the majority of them. We also have problems with native predators like raccoons and river otters that kill the females when they're out nesting and also can take the nests. We lost 8 females this year. So... Yep.
I've never seen a frog that big. I mean, that's a person holding the frog, right?
Yeah.
That's not a doctored photograph, man. That's something out of a 1955 sci-fi movie.
They do very well. So in 2012, we discovered our newest major concern with the species, and this is a disease of the shell. We think it's a unique disease. It's at all 6 of our recovery sites. Of the turtles we've examined, 29 to 49% of them have the disease. And we did a CT scan recently, actually just this year finished it, and it suggests that there's even a higher prevalence and more extreme disease than what we can see externally on the turtles. And we don't know the cause. So this is what it looks like. This is a healthy turtle here. A little bit hard to see, but this turtle has some bleaching, some discoloration of the shell, and there's some pitting or depressions in the shell. This one has both of those things and also a roughened appearance to the shell. When we look at them on CT scans, this is a healthy turtle, bright white bone, no dark marks. These dark marks are actually lesions or holes right through the shells, and it actually appears to us when the disease is very bad as if the shell is just melting away. So this is our top priority currently. We've assembled a health team that has 11 veterinarians with different specialties from all across the country who are interested in helping us with figuring this out, both what the disease is and what we can do about it. But we, of course, have to keep doing our habitat management, our predator control, and our monitoring and research while that's happening. We also are still dependent on our Head Start program, both for supplementation and if we were to start another recovery site. In terms of our recovery goals, we have achieved the number of recovery goals, which is 6, to downlist the turtles, but we still don't have enough turtles at all of those sites to downlist, and we don't have the natural recruitment that we would need to do that. They're not self-sustaining populations. So because we haven't reached our recovery goals, and because of this new shell disease that has us very concerned, and the fact that we still depend so much on management actions to keep the turtles going, we recommend that they remain state-listed as endangered. So we had 5 public comments on the draft. All were supportive. And with this species, we always like to acknowledge all of our partners. This has been a 20-year effort, and we couldn't have done it with all of these dedicated partners working with us to help keep the species of turtle in Washington.
Thank you. Questions from the commission?
You mentioned in the report that it's not clear what impact the shell disease might have on reproduction, but do we have information about reproduction by the released turtles? Are they known to reproduce in the wild?
Yes. So the Head Started turtles, and again, we've been doing this for 20 years, do reproduce. We know that for sure. And we think that because they're turtles, probably even when they're quite sick, they continue to reproduce, whether they lay the same number of eggs, whether that becomes a problem. And then one of our main concerns is we depend on these turtles living a long time, like I said, up to 50 years. And so this disease does look like it gets severe enough that it probably shortens their life. And so right now, and we're working now to figure out fecundity and also if this does in fact kill them at some point. So,
very nice presentation. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit more about the partners that you listed on that second to last slide. The one that caught my eye was the one with the footprint, the Skamania County Forest Youth Success. I think it's a good idea that the department acknowledge the valuable work of our volunteer partners, particularly when it comes to youth. We've been trying to find ways to connect youth to our mission. So you want to explain who these...
Yeah, so this was the Skamania County Forest Youth Group, and they helped with that habitat work that I showed you on that big hill. So we have them come in. They also build basking platforms. We need to replace those on a regular basis because of the importance of that. So we have all these kids out there actually getting them building those, as well as when we remove a lot of that vegetation, you saw those hills, we have to build fences around them so the turtles don't go into them to shelter, because we burn the piles of vegetation. So they also help with that, building the fences. So, and then come out for the releases.
And the other one that caught my eye was the Sustainability in Prisons project.
So we actually are working with 2 prisons, and that's a program through Evergreen State College. and it's been we worked with them for Oregon spotted frogs, and what they're doing with us right now is when we take the turtles into treatment. So one of the things we're trying to figure out is if we treat them, do they stay well? And can we actually treat them effectively and get rid of this disease? So the vets at the zoos are doing, and also at PAWS, are doing that treatment, but we can't, that takes place at a certain time of the year, and then we can't just release them. It's usually winter. So we've gone to the prisons, and they take care of our turtles for us until we're ready to release them again. And so that's been a tremendous help to us, and we really couldn't have done it probably otherwise without their support.
And the prisoners must enjoy it.
They do, and actually, yeah, they write up some blogs and things talking about the impact it's had on their lives.
Not like Birdmen of Alcatraz, but Turtlemen of Alcatraz.
Yep.
We have a partner meeting coming up next week, and some of the folks that are actually treating the turtles will be coming to talk about the remembering.
Yeah, let me just build on that. Those are great stories. Stories like that do need to get out. So I would encourage, in some sort of literature to get those out, because it is a good story. And I was going to say, this seems to me like the whole turtle, a good area for citizen science. Mm-hmm. And even like schools adopting, I don't know all of the protocols because of their listing, but I would, if you've talked to the Pacific Education Institute folks about citizen science, because I could just see this, steamrolling out because it's a popular thing. But I do encourage you to get the more partners. It really shows the broader outreach of the whole department in a lot of things, and it's the right. So well done.
And we always like to mention the zoos, because they've been raising the turtles for 20 years. Woodland Park Zoo started in Oregon Zoo, and they do a lot of our outreach to the public. And it always helps when the public.
Or nature centers, or even the RFEGs that have facilities. This, I think this could get a lot of people interested in science and species.
Thank you.
Has anybody considered an immunological approach, the development of vaccines to stem the disease?
The first thing we have to do is figure out what's causing it. And we're thinking fungal, and we have a professor at University of Illinois working on that. And he is finding a particular fungus that is also been problematic in snakes, but we haven't quite figured it out yet. So once we do, then we'll know how to go forward, whether this is bacterial, fungal, or something, or a virus.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On to wings now.
Now we're moving to wings. This is Derek Stinson's here to talk to you about Sandhill Crane.
I saw that cartoon. Good afternoon. Sandhill cranes have been listed by the state of Washington since 1981. Migratory populations are illegally hunted in 14 states and 2 provinces. They are generalist omnivores and eat all kinds of things, invertebrates, snails, worms, insects, plant material in the spring and summer. And during migration and winter, they have adapted to most often foraging in agricultural fields on waste grains. They have a very high survival. They're long-lived. They have long-term pair bonds and a very low reproductive rate. And the survival of their colts is high once they are strong flyers. In the breeding season, their habitat or nesting areas includes meadows and bogs, marshes, and these sites are generally isolated from human activity. And during migration, of course, they forage in grain fields. At night, they roost in shallow open water. There are 4 flyways and 7 migratory populations, and the 3 that concern Washington include the Pacific Coast lessers, the Central Valley graders, and the Pacific Flyway Canadians. So these are 3 subspecies or forms. The grader breeds in Washington and Oregon and British Columbia. The Canadian is a migrant here, and a portion of those winter here. And the lesser occurs as a migrant. The 3 subspecies are very similar, but the greater and the lesser can be told apart relatively easily by experienced observers. Their migration routes are different. The lesser is the one that occurs in large numbers in the Columbia Basin in eastern Washington. The Canadian is restricted to western Washington, and the greater breeds in Klickitat County, and those that breed in British Columbia migrate through amongst lessers. Historically, they bred more widely in Washington, including in western Washington. They declined with habitat loss and market hunting that occurred until the passing of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. They were extirpated in Washington as a breeder after 1941, and they recolonized in the 1970s. Since that time, they have slowly but steadily increased, and this year there were 98 birds and 37 known pairs. Most of these nesting pairs nest on Convoy Lake National Wildlife Refuge in Klickitat County, and then there are single pairs at Trout Lake NAP, Klickitat River NRCA, and then two or three pairs on the Yakima Reservation and one or more on private lands. The Canadian sandhills spend time on the lower Columbia bottomlands, which is their most important staging area on their migration route. And typically 3,000 or 4,000 are counted each year in late September or mid-October. And the key areas include Ridgefield Refuge, Salvi Island, and Shilapu Wildlife Area. And they started to winter in that area in the 1980s. About 100 wintered there then, and that number has steadily increased until about up to 1,400 have been wintering there in recent years. The Pacific Flyway Lesser Sandhill Cranes, about 25,000, stop in Washington during migration and are the feature of the Othello Crane Festival. The Columbia Basin is probably the most important staging area for these birds. And key locations include our wildlife areas and the Columbia National Wildlife Refuge, private agricultural lands, and then private hunt clubs. Factors affecting sandhill cranes: nesting habitat is fairly limited in Washington, and their habitat can be affected by changes in hydrology, which affects their food and nesting security. The potential for habitat changes or loss as a result of a switch to incompatible crops or development. They're very sensitive to human disturbance. Collisions can be a problem, particularly with transmission lines. And in fact, it's unfortunate, a transmission line runs right across Convoy. And then salmon habitat projects have a possible effect. Management activities include nesting surveys annually that's done by Fish and Wildlife Service and the department and Yakima Nation biologists. And on the lower Columbia, the fall count that I mentioned is done by volunteers. The Fish and Wildlife Service has color banded colts since 1996, and that's led to identifying key stopover sites along the migration route. Research has been done on their genetics. Satellite telemetry has fleshed out our knowledge on staging and stopover sites. These efforts were often funded by International Crane Foundation, done through universities and others. And this year we initiated a local working group to discuss recovery actions. In our recovery plan, the objective to downlist from endangered to threatened include a breeding population of at least 65 pairs, with at least 15 of these pairs outside the Glenwood Valley, which is where Convoy is located. We currently have 37 pairs. Perhaps four or five of these are outside of the valley. Another recovery objective is an average annual recruitment rate of at least 8% for 5 years, and we're currently at 11%. That fluctuates quite a bit depending on the success of each year. And water management control is improved to allow proper management for breeding at Convoy. And that situation has much improved since 2002 with upgraded infrastructure. So in summary, there are three subspecies or forms in Washington. The graders, which nest in modest numbers, less than 40 pairs. Graders that nest in British Columbia stop over in eastern Washington amongst the lessers. For the lessers, the Columbia Basin is the most important staging area. For the Canadians, lower Columbia bottomlands is a critical stopover, around 1,000 winter there. And staging stopover and wintering habitat is affected by development and conversion to incompatible crops. So our recommendation is that the sandhill crane remain on the list of endangered species. We had three public comments on the status report. Two supported keeping the sandhill crane as endangered, and one supported conditionally that if they are genetically distinct or isolated from abundant populations in other flyways, which of course they are. So, questions?
Thank you. That was great.
To better understand the Canadian subspecies and the importance of the lower Columbia bottomlands, as the wintering has increased, do we know whether that's a result of increase in the total population of Canadians, or are we getting a larger proportion that are depending on this highly threatened ecosystem?
I suspect that's a combination of an increase in increasing population, and it may be a climate change situation where the environment is more conducive.
Thank you.
Other questions for Sandhills? Thank you, Ash. I was yeah. Hannah, you always bring interesting stuff.
Can I just
yes.
Add a comment? I want to thank you as well. I just really enjoy these reports, learn a lot, and just to commend your staff. They're doing an excellent job with this. It's one of my favorite parts. Yeah.
So start getting some other critters on the list so we can see more.
Yeah.
Keep rolling, yeah.
Well.
You can do that.
And there's no public input on this, so...
Motion.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to retain endangered status for the woodland caribou, western pond turtle, and sandhill crane as presented by department staff.
Motion's been made. Second?
Second.
Any further discussion?
Which one of them got it? Okay.
Go for the point.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. We'll look forward to the next time.
Uh-huh.